Welcome to today's webinar, hosted by Merrill Corporation. I'm Richard Martin, a Senior Director here at Merrill. I'll be your moderator today. Before we start, I have a few housekeeping notes. First, please send your questions via chat. Panelists will answer questions as time permits. We will also be tweeting throughout the presentation, and if you want to follow us, our handle is at merrillcorp.com, M-E-R-R-I-L-L-C-O-R-P, at Merrill Corp. We will also have three polling questions during our webinar. This allows you to participate and give your opinion. We will capture this data and, for you. The webinar is eligible for CLE credits. You can self-submit according to your state CLE laws, and there will be a link at the end where you can check what those laws are and make the application. There will also be a survey following the webcast, and the replay will be provided within 48 hours. So let's get started. As you know, 2015 was a record-breaking year for global M&A, with an unprecedented $4.8 trillion of deal-making activity. Though some predicted 2016 would follow the similar path, we are over halfway through the year, and clearly the opposite is true. In the first half of 2016, deal values declined by 26.8% to $1.3 trillion across 7,794 transactions, representing a significant decline against the same period last year, where there was a $1.8 trillion value across 8,730 transactions. So certainly, it's an interesting year in terms of M&A activity, or the lack thereof. A year that has been fettered by uncertainty stemming from a U.S. presidential election, numerous significant international geopolitical events, and limited economic growth. In particular, as we come to the apex of what has undeniably been a divisive and eventful presidential race, it seems useful to consider how the candidates' policies potentially stand to impact the private equity sector and M&A activity as a whole. Today, we've assembled an esteemed group of deal-making professionals who draw from their vast experience and are able to offer their insights into what we might expect to see in private equity and M&A throughout the rest of this year and beyond. So I'm pleased to introduce our first panelist, Michael Golden, a founding partner of established middle market investment bank TM Capital. Michael has been responsible for some of TM Capital's most complex transactions for publicly traded and privately held client companies. He has a wide range of experience encompassing a variety of sectors. Next, I'd like to introduce Annette Heide. Annette practices corporate law with a multinational legal firm, Duane Morris, LLP, specializing in the area of transactions and general corporate counseling. She represents private equity and venture capital investors, multinational and domestic corporations, public and private, and a wide spectrum of corporate and transactions. Also joining us is Michael Maxworthy, co-founding partner of R. Marlin, LLC. Max has 18 years of investment banking experience in private equity, experience in advising middle market companies in a variety of sectors. In 2007 and 2008, Max was named to the Investor Dealer's Digest magazine's 40 Under 40. Then again in 2010, Max was recognized by the M&A Advisor's 40 Under 40 list. And finally, it's our pleasure to introduce to the panel Beatrice Mitchell, co-founder and managing director of investment banking boutique Sperry Mitchell & Company, who specializes in arranging the sale or merger of private mid-market companies. Beatrice is a regular lecturer at numerous business schools, including Columbia University, the Stern School, NYU, and the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. She often lends her insights to the Financial and Business Press. So all of our panelists are undoubtedly qualified to weigh on this topic that we're presenting today. We hope that our viewers will also participate by asking questions and taking part in the poll. So if we kick off right away, Beatrice, this is to you. So, can you talk a bit about what the overall impact that you think a Trump win will have in the private equity sector and what you think will happen if Clinton wins?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be here today. I think, quickly, the private equity market is no different than any other market, and if there's any kind of uncertainty, and that can be economic or financial or political, it affects the market. And, of course, we're therefore anticipating an election. There has to be uncertainty. Both Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump have given us some idea of what their economic policies will be, but Mr. Trump has been perhaps vaguer than Mrs. Clinton, and so therefore I would say if he's elected, that will continue to make people not nervous, but uncertain. But more interestingly, both of them have said that they want to tax the carried interest at ordinary income rates, as opposed to capital gains rates, which it is now, and I think that could have, at least psychologically, a bigger impact than anything else they do from an economic point of view. Whether that means there will be less funds raised, which I think what the partners say, who will be earning less money, I don't know, but it's certainly something to talk about. Finally, I'd just like to close with saying that, you know, the vice chair of the Fed, Mr. Fisher, today said that he believes that that we are basically at, I think he said, almost full employment at a 4.9% rate. And in my experience, 5% or less is full employment in this country. If Mr. Trump wins and he decides to deport a bunch of our workers, people who work in the United States, or stop immigration significantly, we will have a labor crunch and wages will have to go up. This will, of course, affect the bottom line for many companies and probably won't be good for the economy.
Thanks, Beth Beecher. That's an interesting point about the carried interest and the labor crunch. Max, what are your thoughts?
Well, overall, I actually think nothing's going to happen very quickly after the election. I think these types of changes inside the after the election, it's usually happened a lot longer than people expect. I'm really going to focus on Trump and make my kind of point here short and sweet. I think that he has way too many personal connections and way too many business connections to really go hard after the market, whether it be carried interest or whatever inside that space. I think a lot of it's just bluster, and I think a lot of it is him trying to look good inside some of the polls just yet. So with that, I think that he's biased. I think that the Irish Gay Group interests a lot with his kind of unpredictability in the way he's talking. I think that makes a lot of people nervous.
Good point. And, yeah, I'd like to stay with you for a moment, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how the outcome of the election will hurt or help directly the firm's ability to raise additional capital.
Sure. So in my experience, LPs actually take their foot off the gas a little bit with looking at the alternative investment class after the elections. They take a wait-and-see approach to where Trump or Clinton will actually focus their attention, and then they'll follow. I think that they're going to – well, let me take a step back. I think that with that, first-time funds, especially sizable first-time funds, will have a very hard time raising capital. I think industrials or infrastructure, which maybe Beatrice can talk about and Mike too here – maybe less so. I think that funds with maybe one or two winners inside them that are really focused on their own IRR will have a very hard time. I think LPs are going to take a much more diverse look at their own portfolios come the election.
Okay. So, I mean, Michael, do you agree there's going to be a little bit of a...
Yeah, I do see some impact coming directly out of this. The two candidates, when you take a look at them, have significant differences on many fronts, but the one that jumped out at me relating to this question is really on international trade and capital flows, where, you know, both are taking positions that are meaningfully different than the current administration. Whether those, you know, positions would ultimately be implemented is another matter, but they could dramatically impact trade and dramatically impact international capital flows. And one candidate is taking positions farther along the spectrum than the other in doing that. So when we think about PE firms raising capital, I think it would be a tale of two tranches of the market. The larger sponsors whose deals are more global and whose sources of capital are more global, I think are more likely to be impacted by the potential outcome of the election. I think where we work in the middle market with many mid-sized companies and mid-sized sponsors, I think many of their businesses are domestic, many of their financing sources are domestic, and so I think these global repercussions, and they could be significant from the election, may not hit their particular more limited sphere as significantly.
Okay, that's somewhat positive for the middle market. If we stay on that thought process, you know, and go back to you, Beatrice, what do you think that the long-term effects would be on the growth of those companies?
I think it's very hard to say. I mean, interestingly, in the post-war era, the economy has grown more under Democratic regimes than it has under Republicans, even though Republicans are supposedly the pro-growth party. So I think it's really very difficult to say. I think the economy is impacted by many, many factors, government policies just being one of them. And, you know, much smarter people than many smarter people than I have opined on this were successful, and I should probably just leave it at that. I would say one thing. I think the Fed has probably had much more of an impact on the economy than anything the current regime has done.
Sure. I mean, I think it's an interesting point you've made that isn't obvious, but Max, if we go back to you, what are your thoughts about
Right off the bat, I think Trump is going to be negative. There's plenty of talk about him talking about it could trigger trade wars. I think there's going to be a decent amount of financial market turmoil after he comes in, with him talking about repealing Dodd-Frank, less regulation for certain industries and the like. Traditionally, Republicans have been viewed as more business-friendly, which is counterintuitive to what Trump is doing. Trump has been in favor of more traditional energy sources, especially in the middle market. So I would see coal, natural gas, and oil as doing pretty good over the next couple of years. Hillary, I think anything dealing with LATAM, EMEA, and APAC would benefit, especially given her stance on immigration, and especially inside the tech sector and business services sector, which rely heavily on that.
Okay. And let's think about or talk a little bit about the things that actually impact growth one way or the other, right? So, Michael, has the tightening of credit availability impacted your deal activity so far this year?
Yeah, I think it's, again, been a tale of two periods. The beginning of the year, there was significant tightening in the credit markets, and I think we all saw that impacting the transaction activity in our markets. But there's been a nice rebound in the markets in recent months. The financing markets have come back strongly, and, you know, lenders are out there, I think, in force and with attractive terms. So we got to really see that rebound pretty quickly. But, you know, the thing we found really interesting of late is that that's not sufficient. The amount of leverage that's available to sponsors has increased and is helpful. But this is such a seller's market right now, and the transactions we're seeing for quality companies, that the valuation multiples have exceeded what you can really, structure in a normal leverage finance kind of environment. And so, you know, the leverage buyout term has been a little bit of a misnomer in this market, as firms have really had to over-equitize deals. And sponsors have definitely had to put in more equity than they would be comfortable with in order to be competitive in this market. And the thing we've really been seeing is that sponsors are over-equitizing deals at closing, but with a vision. And part of that vision is to get some of their bait back pretty quickly as the companies perform. And we sold a company to pretty substantial transaction last year, and that company just a year later just did a $300+ million recap to, you know, take a good deal of the capital off the table. So they're having to work in a two-step fashion.
Okay, and then I want to bring you into this part of the conversation. You know, what are your thoughts about impact of credit availability?
Sure, I agree with what Michael said. You know, the slowdown for the first quarter was predicted at the end of 2015. Everyone thought there would be higher interest rates, which has an effect on the target companies because that will pull down their EBITDA, right? The traditional banks here are continuing to face a lot of scrutiny about how much leverage they should be supplying to private equity transactions. And as a result of all this increased regulation, you've had more non-traditional lenders coming to the market, you know, the non-bank lenders who are playing a role. But the loan environment, I think, is still challenging to the private equity firms. I think through the middle of 2016, the equity and debt markets have settled down quite a bit, so you do have the tail between the two tranches, so to speak, at the beginning of 2016 and now heading into the fourth quarter. They settled down, so credit is more readily available, but I do agree there has been increased equitization required in order to get a deal accomplished, especially given the disparity in the valuation between what the sellers want and what the buyers are willing to pay.
So, if, you know, we have a seller's market, we have over-equitization of deals, some challenges there. But, you know, Max, have you seen a decline in the quality of deals that are coming to market?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I have. Not only in the quality, but also the quantity of deals coming to market. You know, you've got things like Brexit, you've got the Olympics, you've got increase in terrorism, or at least the media attention around it, and you've also got the election this year. And with that, that's a lot of stuff going on this year. I think people are nervous. I think people are excited. One day you're seeing VCs and business owners talk about, you know, down rounds and unicorpses, which I can't stand that term. The next day you have the Dollar Shave Club valuation, which is getting all the media attention. I think businesses today are being smart by understanding their options. You've got smarter boards. You've got smarter VCs over the last couple of years. And with that, they're seeing more and more businesses that may not be of scale yet or even have their business models figured out coming to market and doing what I'm seeing, Mike, you may be able to comment on this too, what we're seeing is kind of dual processes for companies that come into market with not only an idea of what they would do with a small raise, maybe $20 or $50 million, but also what some of the bigger strategic buyers would do with the entire firm based on where it is right now, kind of having all their options on the table all at once. And with that, you're seeing very aggressive pipelines. People are putting people are not prepared, nor do they have the history of putting together some of these, you know, the stories behind their businesses. And there's a lot of guys out there calling BS on that. And that's where you're getting a lot of the decon in the quality of it, where you just don't see the pipeline defendable or being really bad.
Are you seeing the same thing?
Well, I just want to comment sort of historically. Since 2009, it's really been a fantastic M&A market. And I think probably what may have happened here is that last year, anybody who walked was sold. A lot of good companies were, certainly the PE world, which is different from the owners of privately held companies. Anybody who had a portfolio company they could sell, sold. I think probably you're seeing a natural end of a bull cycle, and at the end of a bull cycle, you see decline in quality of product and eventually probably pricing. So I don't think it's quite as – that may be really what's happening. I will say that owners of privately held companies, and from my point of view, that's all we do is sell privately held companies. Our quality has not declined this year, but that's because I think owners of privately held companies tend to sell when – for personal reasons more than anything else. So if you're sick or if you're 72 and you really need to sell, you're going to sell, regardless of where you are, where the market is.
Okay, so it seems like, you know, as you come to the end of the bull cycle, the natural consequences of a slowing of the deal environment. So given that, and then I'm going to ask you this question.
Sure.
What have you noticed in terms of changes and how you, or the way and the methods you use to value targets, how about a change in the way deals are being sourced?
Sure. So I think in valuation, the traditional way for valuation was an EBITDA multiple, right? You looked at the company's multiple and, EBITDA, and you assigned a multiple to that particular industry. You said that's the valuation for the company. Or you looked at multiples of earnings. In today's market, I think there are some valuation methods that are coming to be more popular, maybe not because they're so new, but maybe because there has to be a way for the buyers to justify the disparity in the valuation. So we have methods such as, you know, the customer base. What's the customer base for a particular company? Is this something that's accretive to an existing strategic? Is it accretive to a platform for a portfolio platform company? The cash flow. Is the cash flow good? Is that going to be able to service a whole bunch of debt so maybe you can add more leverage to the company and makes it a more attractive target? The workforce quality. Is this a bunch of workers and employees who are loyal to their company and will continue with the company post a private equity controlled financing and can continue to build the business in the way that they've been building it traditionally? Is there potential for growth for this particular target? You know, is it in a marketplace that's poised for growth? Is this a new market for an existing product such as the Verizon-Yahoo merger? That clearly is Verizon's way to be able to obtain more content to push out to its hundreds of thousands of mobile users. Is it a technology leverage type play, or is it filling a void in competition? So, and finally, the one that everyone looks for is the potential disruption in the marketplace. So I think all of these components are being used to justify the valuation of companies where traditionally I think it was a flat EBITDA multiple, earnings multiple. As far as sources for the way deals are being sourced, I particularly find being what I would call on the an adjunct to the private equity M&A market as we're a legal services provider, that I find a lot of my friends who are either investment bankers or private equity fund professionals looking to their networks broader than just other investment bankers, other private equity players, other corporate strategics, and really reaching out and developing those relationships in a more thoughtful fashion than they have in the past, because what they recognize is that I may have a client, and we deal with a lot of clients who are everything from startup companies to large multinationals that is either looking for an investment, looking to divest itself of a non-performing product line, et cetera. So I may have the inside track on what may be attractive as far as a private equity fund or the need for an investment banking professional to come in and give that client some guidance and help that client find the right market for its for his or her company.
And Beatrice, I saw you nodding your head part of the question, so I'm going to hand it over to you.
I think that was an excellent answer. The only thing I would want to say is that I think there's still plenty of, say, PE shops that do value off EBITDA, and what we see is that people say, oh, my God, I can't believe these multiples. People are paying 10 times EBITDA, and then suddenly, well, if I don't if I don't get into the game, I'm going to be out, and then I'm going to have my investors yelling at me. So I think there's sort of a group think there always has been with the PE world, but it continues to be strong, and so now multiples creeping up, they continue to pay it, and cross their fingers.
Cool. So we're now coming to the first of three polling questions. You know, given the, do you believe that deal volume will increase for the remainder of this year? We're going to give everyone about 30 seconds or so to register their answer. I think this will be an interesting one for us to see how optimistic or pessimistic our audience is, and given the size, I think it might be a significantly relevant sample. So we're getting some good answers so far. Both are in the yes moderately column. Does this surprise any of you by what you're saying so far?
No. No. We're seeing a substantial flow coming into the fourth quarter, so we would agree with the yes moderate.
Yeah, you're looking for that fourth quarter push just to try and get it done mm-hmm. at the end of the year.
That's okay, so we're going to give another 10 seconds or so, and we'll move on. Again, we're going to collate this information and replay it so we can get perspective. I think this is very interesting. So let's move on to our next question now, and let's move away from talking about domestic opportunities here and move a little bit about what's happening internationally. We know what's happened recently in the UK. And so, Michael, if I start with you on this session, do you think we're going to see U.S. buyers pursuing undervalued British-based assets given the uncertainty Brexit has caused? And then what do you think has been the effect of Brexit on European companies in general?
Yeah, based on prior situations, I think there's what we should see and then there's what we actually see in the market, and those are often very different. At TM Capital, we're a member of an alliance called M&A International that gives us cross-border reach, and about a third of our deals are cross-border in nature, so we get to see a lot of the activity. And when you look at Brexit, you say, okay, you have weakened currency, you have weakened valuation, and that should logically drive opportunistic U.S. buyers to take advantage of that situation. But if you look at the markets more broadly, what you see across many, many M&A and market cycles is not a buy low, sell high in general. You look at M&A peaks in general tend to coincide with market peaks. M&A troughs tend to coincide with market troughs. You know, when Lehman went down, it was the greatest time ever to, buy companies. How many companies were getting bought then, if you look at the statistics? Precious few. Unfortunately, the opportunity that is there, the U.S. firms may not really step up and take advantage of it as much as they should. I think the parties who may benefit instead are the continental European companies, which obviously, understand that market better, are closer to it culturally, and who will see the opportunity, I think, closer to home in a way that I think U.S. companies may be more challenged for. So I predict more that it's the continental Europeans that will take advantage of the weakness in the UK rather than the U.S. companies, even though we would advise them that they should seize the moment.
Mm-hmm. Right. It may be a proximity issue. But Nanette, do you agree with that?
Yes, I agree with what Michael said. I think, post Britain's exit from the EU, their currency has dropped, which may present an attractive prospect to a lot of global buyers who are looking for cheap assets and also gives local businesses some incentive to reduce their exposure in the UK. So I do think you're going to see some folks looking. I think you're also going to see some funds that have previously maybe posted a bid in an auction process that failed go back and take a look at that auction process and see if that asset is now available at a price that makes sense for an acquisition.
Okay, thanks. One of our partners, MergerMarket, in their deal review for the first half of this year, they suggest that we're going to see an uptick in deal-making activity across sectors like tech, life sciences, industrials. Max, I'm going to go back to you and ask you, based on your experience, where do you think you're going to see the most activity for the remainder of this year?
Well, I'll answer that in two parts. One is I'll just focus on the industrials piece of that question right now. And for me, that's really an election push. In my experience, generally, you see more industrials and infrastructure projects being funded right after your elections. just to show progress. They're easy things for us to see, people, and it's tangible, and it makes people comfortable. I think PE firms right now are trying to get ahead of that. So you can see increased deal flow right there. And for me, which I really focused on financial services, business services, and TMT deals, my pipeline kind of shows the increased activity. But we're on track to do more in the second half of this year than we did all last year. And we had a very good last year. I'm seeing much more lower middle market deals, probably transaction values under $100 million in transaction value, more so than others. I think a lot of bigger deals have been done, especially inside the TMT space. I think larger strategics are taking more of a, you could call it a VC approach. So they'll spend $1 billion this year, but maybe they'll spread it around 10 or 15 different businesses, spread the risk around.
I think it's an interesting point about the tangibility having an impact on people's interest. And so, Nanette, put the question to you. Where do you see activity, what sectors?
Well, I think everyone's predicting technology to be the most active out of all the sectors in the marketplace for 2016. I think everyone continues, again, to look for market disruptors, and it helps to find that magic market disruptor to make them very wealthy. I think pharma, biotech run a close second behind the technology sector. But I also think the consumer markets are very active. I specialize in consumer products, fashion, and retail. And I think what you're going to see amongst at least the consumer products companies is a lot of divestiture of their non-core assets. So they're going to take a look at their non-performing product lines. And some of those product lines can be very attractive for someone to acquire and launch a platform around. So, for instance, there was a private equity fund that bought Zest and used that to launch as a launch pad to build a whole personal care product line acquisition under a high brand type of banner. So I think you'll see a lot of that activity, especially from the corporate strategics who are getting rid of their non-performing lines.
Thanks. I think that's pretty interesting. I wanted to one quick note to our viewers. We're getting some interesting questions coming in. I think you can tweet as well if you have questions. Again, the handle's at Merrill Corp. If you have questions, you can either chat or you can tweet them. Beatrice, let me turn to you now. Sorry, let's talk about, we have some potential increased activity in certain industries, but let's say, if you're a company and you're a sponsor-backed business, how do you present yourself to be a more attractive asset?
So if I understand the question, I may not be answering the right question, but I think the role of middle market PE firms has evolved over time since I've been in the business to one where you try to take a privately held company and professionalize it. So if this is done right, and a lot of PE firms do this very well, the firm will be the portfolio company 3 to 5 years later will be a different company. It'll be more specialized. It'll have better cost controls. It'll probably have better marketing. It may have done some add-ons because capital has been supplied to them that they didn't have, that they either wouldn't have done on their own or just didn't have access to, so that the portfolio company then is a more attractive asset. And when it is sold, it's usually bigger, probably it's then possible to sell it to a larger PE firm at a higher multiple or to a strategic, which might not have been possible when the company was first sold.
Sure. And then it, okay.
Sure. I think those are great remarks, Beatrice. And I also think you have to be – I think when you're taking a sponsor-backed business to market, one of the things that we see as deal professionals are the ways that the companies come to market. So if you're conducting a large auction process, what we typically see is that there aren't a whole lot of corporate strategics who like to be part of a large auction process. So if that's your targeted buyer, then you're better off not doing a large auction-based type process with your company. And then, I think some of the points that Beatrice made are also true. If you've got the company in an attractive mix of business, that's going to attract potentially more targeted buyers for the company and allow the company to be sold for a higher EBITDA or earnings multiple. And the other things that I think is really attractive in this time period are increased cash flow generation, again, because that could really lead to very many interesting ways to structure or finance the acquisition of the target itself.
Thanks. Max, in one of your introductory comments, you had referenced Dollar Shave Club, so let's go back to them and use them as an example. So recently they agreed to be acquired. Why are more and more companies opting to sell or remain private as opposed to floating a public offering?
Well, the list is actually quite long. just to name more than a few, the tail on 100% cash out for some of these owner entrepreneurs and DCs is quite long, given the lockup periods, restrictive stock terms, kind of percent market dilution, current below IPO market price valuations. They can't match a lot of the private deals that are going on nowadays, not even with the credit marks being where they are. Ego is a big one. The perceived headaches of even being public, which has never gone away. All they do is get harder and harder every year. Different skill set for management. That goes into the ego, but it's also quite scary. I think, and just in my own world, kind of tech IPOs are quite rare. So we don't see them that much. Usually once they reach a certain scale or a certain valuation, there's an asset class there, or there's a strategic buyer that walks in. And in some cases, it makes an offer they can't refuse.
Michael, do you feel the same?
And
what do you?
Yeah, I think Max touched on some of the key points that make an IPO sound much more glamorous than it actually is for the owners of the business. And these are points that won't necessarily be emphasized by the banker, pitching the particular IPO transaction. But it can be a fairly speculative approach to really monetizing your business. As an owner, you have the execution risk of the IPO. You have uncertainty about the aftermarket performance of the security. Critically, you have very limited ability to realize liquidity in the aftermarket, depending on how thin that market is.
Right.
When you stack that up against a private sale that provides 100% immediate cash proceeds, and with rep and warranty insurance these days, you typically are seeing no escrows in those transactions, and therefore you're walking away with 100%. So the question becomes more, I think, why would you IPO? And there are compelling reasons, but we found those usually relate to a unique company where the public market will give it an outsized value that the private market just won't see. But if you don't have that very substantial arbitrage, I think it's hard to justify.
Sure. So I guess the arguments for going public are, finishing to some extent in certain cases. So then what would you think, I'm going to stay with you, Michael, the key drivers will be for growth through the rest of the year? Will it be divestitures, need to put dry powder to use, bolt-ons? What are your thoughts about how this will get done?
You would think you'd be seeing more divestitures now because there are a lot of companies that do have all-strategy businesses that, of right should be hived off. But we're currently handling some divestitures as we speak. But in general, it's really not the flavor of the month. Most larger public companies are trying to show growth and divestiture activity, even if it's a strategic move that makes sense, can work against the growth profile they want to show to the public. So we're not seeing so much of that. But the other factors that you mentioned, I think, are the key drivers of the increase in activity that we are seeing going into the 4Q. So the PE dry powder, and I think one of my colleagues here had just mentioned this, there are a limited number of quality deals in the market, and there's a tremendous fear of missing out among the sponsors when they do see a quality deal. And so we're definitely seeing a feeding frenzy on those, which we're enjoying on the sell side. We also do some advice on the buy side, and we find it frustrating on that side, but that's the state of the market right now. The strategic buyers, I think, are also running a little bit scared in terms of the PE competition that they're facing for transactions, and they typically have lower cost of capital, and they have revenue and cost synergies that they could bake into a deal, but they'd really rather not put those on the table and pay a price that just reflects the core value of the business that they're buying. But we've been seeing more and more of the strategic buyers, emptying the sandbags and taking the steps that are needed to win against PE, and it's definitely made for, I think, what we've all been experiencing as a seller's market. Yeah.
Sure, and Max, back to you. You mentioned you're seeing activity in more middle market, but what are your thoughts about going forward? Anything?
Well, I guess I'm going to differ from Michael here a little bit, where I'm actually seeing a decent amount of secondary buyouts come back to the flavor of the second half of this year, kind of PE to PE deals. Just the other day, I see news about it all the time. Just the other day, I saw a report from PitchBook that back in 2010, there were under 500 that had happened, and now back in 2015, there's well over 1,200 that have happened.
That's a huge amount. I actually attributed to a lot of the dry powder that's been being put to work on both these guys, both sides of the private equity world. We're seeing companies like Silver Lake sell, you know, IPC to Centerbridge, or Apex selling Epicor to KKR. I think that's a decent amount. But I actually do think that a lot of the big deals did happen back in 2014 and 2015. Specifically in my world, you saw things like IDC get bought by ICE, SunGard by FIS, and then even this year with Yahoo and Verizon. So I think you're going to see a decent amount of carve-outs, maybe on the lower end of the middle market rather than the higher end. We're getting calls all the time from people saying, look, I don't think this division fits inside there. I've got a business idea. Or even the management themselves of those divisions coming to us saying, I want to go to the private equity guys and split this off. How do I get that done? You know, it makes management look good at the bigger strategic buyers because they can make a case either way if it's performing or not performing. It makes them look good for their you know, fiscal responsibility for their LPs and their shareholders saying that they're putting money to work. So I actually think we're going to see a decent amount of that coming through, especially with some of the prices are nowadays.
You know, so I promised earlier I wouldn't change the questions, but I have a surprise question because one just came through from the chat. I think it's really interesting. So
fair.
I'm going to throw it out to the group now.
Next to me, Google.
Exactly. The question is, which deal surprised you this year? And is there a deal that you would have wanted to see?
Anyone have any thoughts on that?
I think a deal that I would have liked to see, it's not at Heidi. I think a deal I would like to see was the Office Depot Staples deal. I was disappointed when that one fell apart because I thought there really are not two companies that really don't need to exist in the same world as much as Office Depot and Staples, and yet there they are, still are side by side, both struggling for almost the exact same market share, which from an antitrust standpoint, which I'm sure my antitrust colleagues love, it really doesn't work from an antitrust perspective, but from a consumer perspective, there just really doesn't seem to be a need to me to have an Office Depot and a Staples.
Well, you're touching on an important theme that, you know, we're not hitting here, this question brought up. It's sort of the dog that didn't bark, you know, the deals that didn't happen this year, and a lot of that relates to antitrust. And working with clients who are looking at transactions right now, they're definitely running a little bit more scared as they think about the antitrust implications of transactions when they see, you know, what the responses have been. You can debate whether as a matter of public policy that's a good thing or bad thing, but just from a deal perspective, there are definitely folks who are holding back on transactions, and they're logical deals that, to your point, we're not seeing.
Thanks, and that was a great question from our audience, so thank you. I'm going to move into our next polling question. So we've talked a little bit about deal volume. Let's move on to sectors. What are the top sectors that you think are most ripe for consolidation? Again, we'll give a few seconds for people to reply. Not going to have a pool here, the conversation, but are there any, you know, I guess what we're seeing. I'm curious to see if this surprises you or not.
Pick two.
Okay, I guess, and unfortunately, I think you can only pick one. So, but interestingly, we're seeing a pretty, you know, strong majority of life science or technology. Is this, yeah, I mean, yeah, the comments all kind of included tech companies and consumer products, and so I imagine this isn't a surprise, although the industrials is sort of lower than, you know, based on, I think, the logic of the comment.
Yeah.
I mean, the comment makes complete sense because I think it's interesting. People like to, you know, see and touch stuff, but that's an interesting contrast to our audience. I'm going to give it a few more seconds just to get a last few responses, and then we'll move on. Okay, I think we've gotten most feedback. So, Jeanette, let's start talking about some other details here. The Fed is expected to raise or revisit at least interest rate hikes in September. How do you think this is going to impact M&A activity in both the near term and the long term?
Sure. So I think the interesting question really is how high and how much. If it's an insubstantial amount, which is traditionally what we've been seeing over the past few years, then it's really, I don't think, going to have any impact whatsoever on the M&A markets. I think one person I was reading predicted that it has to be an increase of at least 5% or more in order to have a significant impact on the market. So I think if it's going to be moderate, which is what everyone's predicting, then it's really not going to have a substantial effect on M&A activity. As you know, most, and I think we talked about earlier, most acquisitions are closed using some portion of debt financing. We are seeing that because of the credit markets drying up a bit, additional equitization in the transactions, and then I think it's something one of my colleagues also mentioned before, that there's a two-tier type structure where you go in with a bunch of equitization with a view for restructuring further down the line to return some of that equity back and put some additional debt in place on the target.
The only thing I'd like to add, I thought that was right on. I think the only thing I'd like to add is that I think the Fed will only raise rates if they think the economy is strong. If the economy is strong, probably deal activity will continue. And certainly we've done deals this year where people said, I just want this deal, I'll do 100% equity and worry about it later. But there is so much equity to be put to work that probably makes sense from for many reasons, not just from the financing point of view.
Certainly, and and obviously, that needs to be put to work in an intelligent way. And so, Max, I'm going to come to you and think about how we take lessons from previous deals, such as Verizon buying Yahoo, Microsoft buying LinkedIn, and Time Warner taking a stake in Hulu. What lessons have you observed from these transactions, and how do you think we can apply them to the rest of this year?
Well, I guess two lessons. One is size doesn't really matter. Even LinkedIn at $26 or $25 billion deal, which was massive, they happen still. The other is you can't do it alone. That means that whether you're a $5 million business or a $1 billion revenue business, you need either VC, private equity, you need help. You can either partner with somebody or a buyer. You get more reach. You can make your total addressable market much bigger, much faster. But you need help. Usually, you need somebody to partner with. There's other forms to do that. You can get a different advisory board. You can have a, play with. You need somebody there to bounce ideas off of and help you.
And Michael?
Yeah, our technology team is seeing much of the same in terms of the consolidation. that's been taking place in the sector. And Max was talking about needing help, and it's funny because we often think about the smaller company and a merger needing the help of the resources and capability of the larger, acquirer, which is often the case strategically in the sector. But it's also often the case that strategic buyer needs help and really has some compelling needs that drive the transaction, the cost of replicating the technologies that parties bring to the table, maybe more importantly, the time that it would take to develop that technology and lost time in the land grab in a particular technology market. And the other key thing we've seen in this vertical is that these deals are getting done as much for defense as for offense, that acquirers do want to own these businesses, but they really don't want their competitor to own these businesses, and that helps motivate them as they come up with last, say, 10% of purchase price. So we always find having that second party who someone really doesn't want to have on the business just as important as having the first party who does want to.
That's really interesting. Thanks. So, let's turn now to a big question, Annette. Mega deals versus the middle market. Who could come on top in 2016?
So as we all know, mega mergers drove 2015 to a new record of $5 trillion, beating the previous high set in 2007. And strategic deals in particular, as Michael just mentioned, have really grown in size as larger and larger companies agree to merge or be acquired. So in 2015, there were 69 deals that were over $10 billion, which beats the 2007 record of 43, and that was the last time that 10 deals surpassed the $50 billion benchmark. But as we also talked about, there have been a few deals that have fallen off the radar screen this year, and they were in the tune of $450 billion worth of deals. So that was, again, the Office Depot Staples deal and also the Pfizer Allegrin deal, which didn't close, and a couple others as well. So we're seeing the mega mergers not happening, which is disappointing for a lot of people, especially some of my colleagues at our law firms. There's a lot of private equity dry powder that needs to go to work. So I really think in 2016, you're going to see more middle market come out on top versus the mega deals. I think there are going to be a lot more of the middle market type transactions. You've got, again, a lot of corporations shedding their slow growth product lines that are going to help fuel an uptick for the rest of the year. You've got an improvement in the debt markets, which is also going to fuel more of the middle market deals. And, I think though I think there's a lot of also interest from non-U.S. investors, especially from China, that are that may, though, surprise us and continue to fuel the larger side deals and the larger valuations for some interesting U.S. acquisitions. So it will be interesting, but if I'm a betting person, I'm betting on middle market horse versus the mega deal horse for 2000.
I've written that down here in my little sheets. Keeping track. Just want to keep it a year left.
Just in terms of volume through Q1 of 2016, 89% or almost 90% of domestic M&A activity came from deals that were under $500 million to pitch for. So, I mean,
that's pretty good.
I guess the market's still strong, I think.
Let me stick with you two, Nanette, and go back to you. So are there certain, and kind of going back to the IPO theme, are there certain minimum thresholds in terms of size that might cause you to advise a client to not split an IPO?
Sure. We represent companies of all different sizes and all different stages of their life cycle. And if you've got a company that needs a capital, wants to do a capital raise of less than $50 million, then we typically would ask the question, why do you feel that the public markets are the right place for you to seek the capital to fuel your growth? There are so many other avenues out there to finance the company, and so many more of them are more user-friendly and will help you so much more in an exponential growth pattern versus going to the public markets, becoming subject to public scrutiny, having to incur the cost of the public filings, and really on the constraints on your business operations in some respects, because everything you do is subject to public disclosure. So anything below $50 million, we would advise the company to really sit down and determine if that's the right position for them. One of the newer ways to go public, though, is what's called a Reg A Plus type securities filing. A Reg A Plus is like a baby IPO. It's really for up to $50 million. So if you really feel the need to go forward with the public financing, the Reg A Plus is interesting because it's subject to less scrutiny by the SEC. You still get the full testing the waters communications ability, and it's a lot less expensive, you know, than going through a full IPO process with an underwriter and two sets of counsel and whoever else may be involved. So if it's less $50 million or less, either we say really think about staying private or do a Reg A Plus type financing. And then if you really want to do something that's really fast, then you could always explore what we call the alternative IPO filing, which is where you merge into a publicly listed company that has little or no operations, and you can become public by filing what's called the Super 8K, which is not subject to SEC review, so you can become public the day after you file the Super 8K and start trading on a market.
Thanks. Beatrice?
I think just going back to what one of my colleagues here said, which is that, of course, all the regulations of being public are such a pain, and if you don't know how to do it and you have to learn on the job, that's very expensive. I wanted to just make an historical point of view, which is that when I started in this business, there was something called, I think they're still around, the pink sheets. You guys remember the pink sheets?
The FCCPV.
And, you know, the PE world, the private equity world, has really filled or created an alternative way for people to raise money. And so when I started this business, you know, we sold to strategics because the PE world was very small and everybody was doing a completely leveraged deal. There was very little equity going to any deal. So I think the PE world has come along in a very nice way and said, here's an alternative to going public.
Thanks. Michael and Max, earlier you talked a little bit about some of the types of deals we're going to see. And so I'd like to focus a little bit on, starting with you, Michael. What are the trends you're seeing in terms of how those deals are getting done, sort of the financing structures?
Yeah, I think as we had mentioned earlier, you know, the leverage levels had come down early this year, but the leverage levels are increasing. Covenants are definitely loosening up as we're seeing that. And a lot of that is not being driven by the traditional banks. There are non-bank private funds that are being raised, non-BDC funds being raised that, you know, have really succeeded in raising a lot of capital in these markets, have become an important factor in the debt markets, and have really been taking share away from, again, the more regulated financial institutions that are, you know, a little bit more hamstrung in competing in the marketplace. And they're playing all the way through the capital structure, from revolvers down to
stretch senior and second lien positions. So the identities of the players have changed. The structures have become a little bit more creative and more aggressive, and this feels like a trend that is here to stay.
Nash, are you seeing similar?
So I'm going to take a different tack on that, but actually I agree with everything Michael said, and I'm going to really focus more on the larger strategics inside my world, the CMT world, where I think a lot of them are hedging their bets with some of the higher valuations that are coming out there. I agree with Michael, you're seeing different leverage levels come out, not as aggressive as they used to be. And unfortunately, seeing the earn-out terms come into deals to bridge some of the gaps on valuation. So you're still getting guys who have small, mid-market, maybe private companies that still think very highly of themselves. And in certain cases, the strategics are telling them to keep their money where their mouth is. And with that, you're getting guys with earn-out structures on the deals. We're certainly seeing more and more.
Sure. Thanks. And, so you go from companies that think highly of themselves to I want to kind of move, and Nanette, start with you. What about distressed assets? Have you seen an increase in distressed asset sales this year? And if you have, or whenever you've seen, do you think this trajectory will continue the rest of this year?
There's always distressed assets available. It just really kind of depends upon which industry is the flavor du jour to be the distressed assets of the year. So I think for 2016, you're really seeing a lot in the oil and gas sector. I think with respect to natural resources, these companies believe that the value of the natural resources is far exceeding what they're being offered as far as investments. So they'll go through a bankruptcy proceeding in order to divest themselves of the natural resources at a much higher price than they can get in a traditional investment setting. I think in the retail sector, you're certainly seeing a whole host of distressed filings, but the question becomes what's really valuable about a retail company. You've got Sports Authority that just went through their bankruptcy filing, but the assets there are very limited because it's really just a bunch of real estate that maybe nobody wants to put their hands on. And the oil and gas exploration companies, you're also seeing those companies need liquidity, so they're willing to go through a distressed asset sale. But I think on a global basis, what's interesting is that you are seeing a lot of distressed assets being picked up globally in interesting countries, like in India, there's a whole host of distressed assets that are being picked up by non-U.S. investors, and they think that's a good bet. And again, the U.K., I think you're going to see a few distressed assets that will come to market that may be attractive for either U.S. investors or foreign investors.
Thanks. And Michael, what about you? What are you saying?
Yeah, and then that picked up on a very important point, which is it's so sector specific. There have been markets like we had, half a dozen years ago where a number of sectors are distressed, and really it's a meaningful portion of the M&A market. I think today we're in a very healthy economic environment and very healthy M&A market, and therefore it's unusual to come across distressed transactions. And where you do, it really is very sector specific, with energy being the number one source of the transactions that we see in that space. So we're wrapping up a successful distressed sale transaction at TM as we speak, and it's actually in consumer vertical, going as many of our distressed sales have gone to an international buyer. We found international buyers be our number one resource in selling distressed businesses because they are taking a longer-term view of having the opportunity to expand geographically into this market and maybe going to look past some of the issues that a domestic acquirer might look at. But as a proportion of our overall business, and I think the M&A markets, it's at a very low level these days because outside of the energy sector, even companies that are having some hiccups, the banks are continuing to be willing to lend and tie them over to what they hope will be a better day. So this is a very cyclical category in our business.
Okay. Yes, that makes sense. We're coming now to our third and final polling question. We've talked a little bit about deal volume. We've talked a little bit about sectors, and this one is really talking about who's going to drive M&A activity for the remainder of this year. Is it the financials, the strategics, combination of both? I'm curious to see what this will be and how this will act. So we're seeing, does any of this surprise you when you're looking at the screen, the strategics? Well, it's actually pretty well. Not quite even, but the strategics are kind of leading. Then, does it shock anybody in the room? No.
No.
So we'll just give it a few more seconds to people to respond, then we're going to come into our final questions for the group. Okay. So with boards under pressure, Max, I'd like to start with you on this one, right? With boards under pressure to drive growth, do you think we're going to see more investor activism as an M&A activity driver throughout the remainder of this year and into the first quarter, early beginnings of next year?
I think there's going to be a lot more, activism. I just think there's going to be a lot more people talking about it, a lot of people more acting for different ideas on some of the companies. But do I actually think that there's going to be much more activity and deals getting done that way? No, I don't. I think that there's going to be much more scrutiny on some of the M&A opportunities that are coming to market with kind of activism behind them, with boards being more willing to say, no, nowadays, we're not going to do that. Here's incredible detail why. I think that there's a much more kind of conservative view, at least in the short term, on guys on boards taking it into consideration, but I think that they're much more nowadays, much more verbal on saying this is the wrong way, this is the wrong approach for us. I'm happy to get into a public fight with you over this, but I think just because you're coming in and asking for something doesn't mean necessarily it's best for the business.
And Beatrice?
I don't really have much to add to that, except to perhaps say that I don't think that the activism necessarily works in terms of share price,
sure.
Either short selling or suggesting that. I think look at Yahoo, they sold it off and stock price didn't move. So.
Sure. I think you're in the nods a little bit at the end of the answer, but Michael or Nanette, you want to comment on the last question?
Sure. I think shareholder activism is very interesting. I do think there have been some divestitures that have been appropriate. Let's look at the Red Lobster divestiture of all the real estate holdings, because who needs to own that much real estate? And you divest it and sell it to a REIT. I think that's a great idea, because the REIT knows what to do with it and how to run those assets and can make a nice return for the money, some of the REITs. But it's an interesting idea, but I do think some of the shareholder activism is misplaced, and I think the board should be saying no and taking a careful look and not feeling that they're being bullied into accepting an idea just because the shareholder says that you should do this.
Great. Thank you. We've had a lot of questions, and we've come to the top of our hour, so unfortunately we don't really have the time, but we will get back to everyone who's asked a question and make sure you have an answer or the ability to reach out and get some information. I'd like to first just say thank you very much to our panelists for joining us today. It's really a big deal for them to take time out of their busy schedules and share their wealth of information with us, and I'm very appreciative of that. I also want to thank our guests who joined us today and took the time out of their days to listen to our panel discussion tonight. I sincerely believe this has been very useful, and we have interesting information we're going to share. So, again, we will be sending out the replay and the slide deck within about 48 hours by the end of this week. If you want to apply for your CLE credits, we have a link here, the CLEReg.org organization. Check your state laws, but this webinar does qualify on that. And I'd like to call the webinar to an end today and thank everyone for joining us. Have a great afternoon.